Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we hear about the fight to save the Spindle, Berwyn's 40-foot-tall car kebab. We talk to the man behind Mamma Mia Pizza Beer. We get a Londoner's perspective on Midwest water parks. And we hear about a man who's selling America by the square inch. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. In one West Chicago suburb, community activists are looking for some way to salvage what's often called its most recognizable landmark. 18 years ago, the owners of a Berwyn strip mall commissioned California artist Dustin Schuler to produce the Spindle, or eight stacked cars with a large spike running through them, set in the middle of a parking lot. But developers now want to build a Walgreens in its space and dismantle the car kebab sometime around Labor Day. There are supporters of demolishing it who say it's become an eyesore. The cars have rusted a lot since the late 80s, and they're covered by pigeon droppings. Yet many more are coming out in defense of moving the local icon and want to find a way to save it. The Spindle got national exposure in 1992 when Wayne, Garth, and their buddies drove by it in the movie Wayne's World. It has also been featured on a beer ad and a book cover. The sculpture has many fighting to save the monument, but they can't pay the price tag to move it.
There's an awful lot of people that have an awful lot of interest in it, but to my knowledge, there hasn't been a fund set up.
That's Berwyn Mayor Michael O'Connor. He says estimates to dismantle the structure run anywhere from $75,000 to $350,000, figures that its private owners probably won't come up with.
I think they probably missed an opportunity to raise the money to save it, but the owners haven't decided whether or not they're going to save it or not, and whether or not they wanted to make the investment.
The owners of the property, as well as Concordia Realty, who manages the property, couldn't be reached for comment. O'Connor says the dispute over the Spindle is good press for the city, and he's all for keeping it. The mayor says he would prefer the monument be saved and moved just to the west. But O'Connor says he's also realistic, knowing that some costs would be committed solely to rehabbing the cars.
Because let's face it, it's cars out in the elements. They rust, and the paint's all wore off, and it looks good from Harlem Avenue at about 500 feet away, but when you get up close to it, it looks like eight cars all rusting stacked on top of one another, which is exactly what it is. So there is a problem with keeping it clean, and there is a problem with the longevity of the piece.
And the mayor and other city administrators in Berwyn aren't the only public officials who have gone on record supporting the structure. State Senator Michael Sandoval of Cicero has filed legislation that urges the city of Berwyn and Concordia Realty to negotiate to keep the Spindle a permanent part of the city's landscape. The Berwyn Arts Council has started selling T-shirts in an attempt to move the Spindle. They're just one of several area nonprofit groups that have gotten behind the project. Maggie Regatius has spearheaded a website called SaveTheSpindle.com. It updates preservation efforts and organizes events, like a recent benefit concert. On one of its many bike rides, members of Chicago Critical Mass pedaled their way to the Spindle from downtown Chicago. Regatius says even she was taken aback by their efforts.
We had originally heard that there might be 50 people, and we stood in the plaza. We had a number of citizens standing around waiting just to welcome them in and everything, and we looked, and the bicycles started coming and coming and coming, and 2,000 bicycles later... the plaza was full of people.
Regatius says there are really no bad guys involved in the dispute over the Spindle, noting she welcomes the Walgreens. But she's determined to somehow uphold the vision created by artist Dustin Schuler in the late 80s. Jeff Bossard spoke with Schuler on the fight to save the Spindle and what inspired him to create the automotive icon.
I saw cars as a possibility as art objects, or I could use them in my work. I'm a sculptor. And, the idea of putting them up and on a spindle just really struck me. So it was kind of an epiphany when I had it. Now, and I went ahead and did a model, but I had no, I thought most people, this is kind of outrageous. They don't get it. But finally a guy did get it, and he paid for it. And we worked out a deal whereby it would be safe for 10 years, because my hope was that if it had at least 10 years, people would, you know, initially they might be shocked, you know, and say, oh, what is this? But then after an amount of time, they could really come to love it. And I think there's that might have happened. I mean, I've had a lot of stuff destroyed in the past, but this one I think has a chance. And so I hope so. I really do. I think it's beautiful. So, Jeff, you got anything else?
Well, what is it going? What are the plans for moving this?
Well, you know, I mean, it's been going on for years, this Walgreens thing. And, you know, of course, the shopping center, I mean, the owner used to tell me, listen, I got to, you know, I make my money from these shopping centers and I spend it on art. So we got to work something out. And that's how we worked out the 10-year deal. So I knew about it, but the plan was to move it. Now, apparently prices have gone up in 18 years. Oh, surprise. So whether or not they'll do it, I don't know. I mean, the shopping center owns the piece. I own the copyright, and I own my intrinsic rights as the artist of the piece. But, you know, so I don't know. But I think it's going to make a big difference that the people there, the people that grew up with it, quite frankly, when I put that up, some of these people were just little kids, and it's become part of their life, and they want to keep it. And I say more power to them.
So how in the heck you get a bunch of cars to stack up on this spindle?
Well, as long as you don't violate the law of physics, it's no big deal. It's only a matter of budget. So, you know, I pre-cut the holes, and we use the crane. We put the spike up. You know, I had lots of crews, people I work with. And then it took 2 days to lower the cars down, because between each car there were supports to the common spike. So it took some time, but it wasn't that big a deal.
And did this piece bring unexpected celebrity, or did you fully anticipate something like the whole Wayne's World thing and other, I guess, more people taking pictures of it, et cetera?
I just went with serendipity, you know, whatever happened. I thought from the beginning I had great faith in it. I really believe this would be something that was worth spending part of my life to bring to, you know, reality. And if I didn't do it, nobody else would do it. But, you know, what's happened since, it amazes me. I think it's wonderful.
You think you'll still be well-remembered for this, even though they've got to move this icon?
Sure. Even if it's, well, yeah, I'm not worried about that. Even if it's destroyed, which would be a shame. But, you know, like I say, I've had other stuff destroyed. The images are still available. I mean, you have to consider 6 of the 7 wonders of the ancient world are gone. All we have is the stories, not even any photos. Nothing on YouTube. So I would have liked to have seen that statue in, I forget what the city was, the statue of Alexander spanning the straits, you know. But it's probably gotten bigger over time. Although I want to say, because I know there's a lot of misinformation out there, the spindle is 50 feet tall, not 40, 50, 5 stories.
And what vehicles are on it?
A Volkswagen on top. I like Volkswagens. I always did. I used to drive one. And I thought that was perfect for the top, a red one, you know. And then the second car down belonged to the owner of the shopping center, David Bermant, who was my patron, friend, mentor, father figure. And so that was his car that I said, Dave, we got to have your car. So he wanted it on top, and I said, no, the Volkswagen's got to be on top. So his car second, and then, I don't know, there's a Mustang, there's a bunch of Fords on there. I didn't pick them for their... because of the make, I picked him for size and color and shape. I'm kind of a painter.
Jeff Bossert spoke with Dustin Schuler, the California-based artist behind The Spindle. For more information on the effort to save the Berwyn Monument, check out SaveTheSpindle.com. Thank you. You're listening to Sidetrack. China's economy is growing rapidly, and along with it, a growing middle class that increasingly can afford cars and motorcycles. With each day, there's 1,000 new cars on the streets of China's capital, Beijing. But for the majority of Chinese, in rural and in urban centers, the bicycle is still the preferred mode of transportation. Because of this, bicycle mechanics can be found everywhere in China. They often set up their workshops under large trees on university campuses or in shady corners of residential areas. One bicycle mechanic even made his way from Beijing to Champaign. AM580's Michael Kaliska has more.
Yeah. Li Cheng sits on a little chair fixing bicycles for sale. He's surrounded by about 40 bikes and bicycle frames in his son's garage in Champaign, Illinois.
How is the business going now?
Just so-so, he says. The 71-year-old's muscles flex as he works on the bikes.
He doesn't consider this as a business. He thinks that's fun. For him, that's fun.
Li Min, his son, completed his PhD in agricultural science just recently at the University of Illinois. His father has lived with him in Champaign for the last 4 years.
In China, if you think of the business, I mean, they make a huge money. He said that's just for his hobby, for fun. Yeah. He doesn't like people think it's a business.
Li Cheng started fixing bikes 17 years ago when he was still living in a village in Shaanxi Province, China. He used to work in a steel factory for most of his life, and he considered fixing bikes a good segue into retirement. After a few years working from his home, Li Cheng moved to Beijing. His son and his daughter-in-law studied at the Agricultural University in China's capital.
I went to Beijing with my wife, and at first I didn't plan to do any business in Beijing. I only wanted to take care of my grandchild. But then I thought, how can two adults take care of one child? And I said, okay, I actually can make some money. And so I started fixing bicycles.
Near one of Beijing's ring roads, Li Cheng put up his transportable workshop. He had it set up under a big tree on the campus of the Agricultural University so that he could work in the shade. But this cool spot had its monthly price.
I had to pay 200 yuan to the school administration so I could fix bicycles on the campus.
There are thousands of bicycles on every university campus in Beijing. There are rows of parallel bike stands up to 200 feet long. So clearly, there was plenty to do for Li Cheng.
There was no competition. That is why I pay the 200 yuan, because they wouldn't allow anybody else to come to the campus to fix bikes.
For 2 years, Li Cheng repaired bikes in Beijing and took care of his grandchild. Then, in 1997, his son left for the United States to study at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
I didn't want them to move to the U.S. because I was thinking about my grandchildren. When they learn English, then won't go back to China because of the language and the culture. And if the children stay in the U.S., their parents will stay with them. So at that time, I really didn't want them to leave for a country far away.
After his son left, Li Cheng and his wife went back to his native village for the next few years.
I prefer to live in the countryside. There are a lot of people I know, and it's much more relaxing. In Beijing, there are a lot of unwritten rules. For instance, you can't dress very simple. A t-shirt often won't do. And when you talk to people, you have to carefully present yourself. It's not as easy as in the countryside, where you can do whatever you want as long as you don't break the law.
After visiting the U.S., Li Chong and his wife finally moved to Champaign and have stayed there with their son since 2003. In Chinese tradition, the son of the family will take care of the parents, and so Li Chong followed his son to America, knowing he wouldn't see his four daughters for a long, long time.
No, I didn't sell a bike today. The business is not too good. I am just sitting here because we don't do much advertising. I just sit here and wait.
But altogether, Li Chong says selling bikes in the U.S. is easier.
It is very easy to sell bicycles to Americans because they don't bargain. And if they like the price, they will get it and go. And I always ask for a moderate price. It's really hard to bargain with Chinese. They always want a very low price, and you spend a long time on bargaining.
Li Chong's son, Li Min, usually does the bargaining, since the father doesn't speak English. Li Min says they get their bicycles at garage sales.
My parents is okay. Now they actually make good money for them. I mean, yeah, if they one bike they make $10-$15, it's still they don't spend at all. Yeah, even they have a health problem, we bring them to Carl.
Although life is relatively cushy for Li Chong and his wife, he wants to go back to China. He says he misses his relatives and life in the village.
I may never come back to the U.S. because I got my visa only for a year. But now I am already here for 4 years, so I am way over what the visa allows. So I think there won't ever be a chance to get a visa again to visit my son.
Yeah, he really want to go, but I think if he can wait another year, we can apply for a green card for him. Yeah, next year we try green card for him. Once they have a card, they can go back for us. I know they want to go home. Also, they want to come back again, I'm sure. But, you know, they always, for older people, they always want to visit. If you have a sibling, you know, they always want to look that one too, visit this one too.
The family's home village, Haobi, is about 15 hours by train from Beijing. It is a slow train, and to keep travelers entertained, there's a constant stream of music, whether you want it or not. But at about 10 p.m., the light will be switched off, at least in the sleeper's compartment. It takes another 20 minutes by car from the county capital Jishan in Shaanxi province to get to Haobi. Most of the roads are new, but the ongoing construction actually created some bumpy stretches. Haobi's village head, Jujisha, is Li Chong's son-in-law. Jujisha is married to Li Chong's oldest daughter, Lu Jufeng. They live in a big double-story house with an enclosed yard. Jujisha is proud that he has family in the U.S.
It is a big deal, and the people in the village feel honored to have a brother abroad. Only a few people make it to college, so going abroad is even more rare.
Jujisha says he helped Li Min to pursue his career.
We used to repair cars together. We're pretty close because I supported him to finish his studies. His family is not very rich, and I gave him the money to continue his studies, so he's important to me.
Jujisha owned a car repair shop before he became village head. He says the economic growth in China can even be felt in the village. Many people go out to work in the big cities, and there are a lot of new houses being built.
You can see it from our average income per person. Before, we had only several hundred per head per year, but now we have about 2,800 to 3,000 yuan. And the agricultural production has increased a lot, too. So it's amazing how people's quality of life has improved.
Yet converted, this is only about $400 a year. But Jujisha is a living example for the overall improvement, since he can pay for the education of all his three children, who now study at universities across China. To have so many kids is unusual for a country that is regulated by the one-child policy.
No, our children were already born when the one-child policy was introduced, so we didn't get punished.
Jujisha's wife, Liu Chufang, says she sees her children about twice a year. They study far away from home and left the house several years ago.
I miss them a lot, but they don't have time to come home more often. And my oldest daughter only comes once a year, only for the spring festival, the Chinese New Year.
That the whole family is scattered all over China and the U.S. makes Li Chufeng a little sad, but she smiles.
It is not what you want, but what will be. Li Min hasn't returned to China for more than 10 years, so my parents had to travel to the U.S. But yes, it would be nice to get the whole family back together again.
For Li Jiefeng, there's not much choice. Life will go on as usual. Every day, she gets up at 5:30 in the morning to work in her 1.5-hectare field, where she grows wheat, soybeans, and corn. Many of the fields have an underground water irrigation system to ensure better crops. And even though Li Jiefeng uses machines, she still does a lot by hand.
It is pretty tough, but this is the countryside. Everything here is like that.
A 5-minute walk away through the village's concrete lanes lives the youngest of Li Chong's daughters. She's a hairdresser. Li Shuli opened her very Spartan hair salon about 15 years ago in her house. There's one very old and creaking hairdresser's chair. Her customers are mostly the men and boys of the village who sit and wait on simple wooden benches. A haircut and shave costs about 2 yuan, that is, little more than a quarter in US currency.
Living expenses in the village are very low. I don't have to pay any rent since this is our house. So although I make little money, I spend very little as well.
Li Shuli is taking care of her parents' house, which at present belongs to Li Min as the only son in the family. But she will leave the village once her son starts high school in a bigger city.
Let's see, maybe my mom and dad will come back this year. If not, we might just lock this place up and leave it empty.
But until then, Li Shuli takes also care of the family field, a plot of land that is about half a football field in size. She says she really would like to see her brother and her parents again.
It's so far away that we can't even visit Li Min and my parents. When Li Min was studying in Beijing, I visited him once. I was quite young then, but America is not Beijing. It is too far away.
It is more than 6,500 miles from Haobi to Champaign, where Li Chong is contemplating whether he will stay in the United States or if he'll go back. He says the grandchildren are now big enough and he doesn't need to be around anymore. And since he doesn't speak English, he feels a bit limited.
Sometimes I go to the shops with my son or my daughter-in-law. While they are shopping and talking to the people, I just keep quiet and look around.
Oh, my shirt's getting wet!
The grandchildren, Virginia, David, and Timothy, speak only a little bit of Chinese. But 11-year-old Virginia, the oldest of the lot, says she finds it easy to talk to her grandfather.
Well, I find ways to communicate with him because I know a little bit of Chinese, and then he asks me to do things and I just do them. So, like, sometimes I have to just tell him something and then he doesn't understand what I'm saying.
Okay? Can you go to your room, 好吗? To play your game, 好不好? Davy, go to your room. Good boy. Good boy. Okay.
Li Chong's daughter-in-law and wife to Li Min, Jin Yingping, says that although it is sometimes difficult to live with the in-laws under one roof, she would like them to stay.
I'm fine, yeah. Even you see, this generation is have a gap, yeah. But I'm fine since we both from the same place. We know each other. We know, yeah. So I'm okay, and we need them. I think also better for them, yeah. But when they live home, so they need to work a lot.
For Li Chong and his wife, it is a double-edged sword to live in the United States, torn between family ties and being homesick. He will have to decide.
In Chinese traditional culture, you say that you will spend your whole life with your wife, but you can only spend half your life with your children. I can't follow them all my life.
That story from AM580's Michael Kaliska. Still to come on the program, a man in St. Charles has come up with a beer that tastes like pizza, and we hear an essay about a Londoner's discovery of Midwest water parks. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. For $3.95, you can own a piece of America. Granted, it's only a square inch, but still, for the change you can find underneath your couch cushion, you too can be an honest-to-goodness landowner. This is all thanks to Scott Moger, founder of Own a Piece of America. From Alaska Public Radio, Rebecca Shear has the story.
When you think about buying and selling land, what comes to mind? Some waterfront property somewhere? A big empty lot, maybe some farmland, ripe for the picking. Whatever it is, chances are it's somewhat broad, right? Open, expansive, a couple of acres at least. Well, out on the East Coast, there's a guy who makes his living by taking those acres, breaking them down, and selling them by the inch.
$3.95 will get you a square inch in any state you choose. If you want to go for big bucks, $19.95 starting at, you can get square inches of land in all 50 states.
This is Scott Moger, speaking from some of the finest square inches of land in his native New York, Central Park. Moger's the founder of Own a Piece of America, a company that allows anyone with $3.95 jingling around in their pocket to become a real, honest-to-goodness landowner. Not that there aren't some rules.
The deed spells it out quite clearly that you can't make any profit from your one square inch, and you can't build on your land, you can't live on your land, you can't retire on your land.
It was actually retirement that kickstarted this whole business. When Moger's parents retired to Florida, he cleaned out their apartment.
My mother and father threw out all my baseball cards, but I did find something that I had when I was 10, 11 years old. It was a deed to the Yukon, and that's a very interesting story.
Actually, it is. See, in the 50s, when Moger was 10, 11 years old, there was this radio show, Sergeant Preston of the Yukon.
Sergeant Preston was typical of the small band of Northwest Mounted Police who preserved law and order in the Yukon during the gold rush of 98. But in spite of the odds against them, the challenge of the North was answered, and justice ruled triumphant.
It was sponsored by Quaker Oats, and in 1954, Sergeant Preston was about to make his big jump from radio to TV. But the show's ratings were dropping, as were Quaker's sales. That's when they launched what Moger considers one of the greatest sales promotions ever.
They acquired land in the Yukon, and they offered a deed to the Yukon, a square inch of land, in every cereal box.
And Moger unearthed his original 1954 deed back in 81, when he was cleaning out his parents' apartment.
And that was my aha moment. I said, what else can I do similar, but better?
Up till then, Moger had actually been in the movie business, marketing big blockbusters for Columbia Pictures. But he was so excited about this new endeavor that he put his film career to the side and started writing letters to brokers and real estate agents nationwide asking to buy an acre of land. He started with Alaska.
And it was an acre in Chitina.
That's Chitina, at mile 34 of the Edgerton Highway.
And that cost $3,500. And I soon realized I couldn't buy 50 acres across the country at that money. So I did revise my letter and made sure they know that I wanted to pay $100, $200, wherever the acre might be.
Now, an acre of land contains about 6.3 million square inches, or as Scott Moger knows all too well.
Exactly, 6.272640 million square inches.
So you do the math. At $395 a square inch, even with that 50 states for a 1995 deal, that could lead to a lot of bucks. And yet Moger says this is the first year he's pulling a profit. He's got a website to maintain, a four-person staff to pay, deeds to frame or mount on plaques, depending on the buyer's preference, plus the biggest expense of all.
Yes, we pay all the taxes. We do all the work for them. And you just sit back, have fun, and tell everybody, I own a land in Alaska.
Which, to be honest, sounded too good to be true when I first found Moger's company on the web. But if you do your homework, you'll see that he is listed as a landowner in the Valdez and Chitina Recorder's office. And he received approval from the SEC as a novelty item, which is just fine with him.
If by now you haven't figured out a square inch is just for fun, just for daydreaming, just to say I own land in Hawaii, as an example, because that's where you want to retire, you want to live there someday, or in Alaska, as it is many people's fantasies to own land or go to Alaska.
And in fact, Alaska is the fifth highest seller, right behind Florida. But if sales keep up, Moger predicts the last frontier will inch past the Sunshine State soon.
That story from Alaska Public Radio's Rebecca Shear.
We'll be right back.
you've got attuned to Sidetrack. Many people enjoy a cold beer with a slice of pizza, but for one microbrewer in St. Charles, pizza is the inspiration for his latest brew. It's called Mamma Mia Pizza Beer, beer that tastes like pizza. The creator of this concoction is Tom Seaforth. I talked with him recently and asked him first where he got the idea of putting these two flavors together.
Well, you know, as a home brewer, you have the flexibility of kind of making any flavor that you want to make of beer. And the only critic is yourself. And if it's no good, you either cook with it or throw it away. We had made a beer a couple years ago with a bunch of garden herbs that turned out fairly well. In fact, it won some awards at some contests. And again, this past Labor Day, we had some extra tomatoes, and we've kind of been kicking around something new to do with making beer. And my neighbor, he grows garlic like crazy and brought me a bag of garlic, and he kept on talking about like garlic beer and stuff. I'm like, I don't know. So anyway, it was raining that day, and the weather was bad, and my wife and I were talking to each other about this crazy idea about taking tomatoes and making beer with them. My father-in-law lives in Texas, and he uses tomato juice with his beer. You know, they call it like a red eye or something like that. I don't know if you ever heard of that before.
No, I haven't.
It's like a beer wow. Bloody Mary.
Okay.
So he bragged about how good it was. So we tried it one time with a regular premium beer, and it really wasn't half bad with hot sauce on it. So we figured, worst-case scenario, the beer will taste like that. All right? And so anyway, after a week in the fermenter, we racked this stuff into a secondary fermenter to let it clarify, and we usually get a sample out of it, and I drew a sample, and I tasted it, and I looked at my wife, I said, oh my God, try this out. And no sooner did I turn around that the glass was gone. She drank the whole thing. And she's like, this is cool. It tastes like pizza and beer. So in a nutshell, we had the beginning of pizza beer.
Which is crazy, because usually people will have a piece of pizza, and a beer, and, you know, kind of let it all mix up on the inside instead
exactly.
of mixing it up beforehand.
That's exactly what we were trying to do, because a lot of people are like wine snobs, and they're like, oh, all I want to have is, I want to have my Zinfandel or my Cabernet with my pizza or my pasta or my Italian foods. And we're like, why should beer be ignored? So we went ahead and spiced the beer. You know, I mean, people don't think Blue Moon is crazy for putting oranges in beer, do they?
I guess not. Some people like that.
All right. People put lime in their Tecate and their Corona, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So why not a little basil, oregano, tomato, and garlic in your pizza
beer?
Well,
yeah, it's a little different from the fruit flavors. Absolutely. But, you know, here's the thing that kind of got me. I saw some news footage of you actually brewing this stuff up.
Yes.
And in the news footage, I mean, you put in the tomatoes and the garlics and all that other stuff, but you actually dropped in a couple of slices of pizza for good effort.
That's exactly what we did for good effort. We figured for the fun of it, we may as well go ahead and dump a couple pizzas in this thing, too, and see what happens. And basically what happens is that when the pizzas went in and the spices went in, you create what we call like a cereal mash. So these pizzas were made of like wheat dough, water, yeast. There's no animal products in there. We didn't put any cheese in there. We didn't put any pepperonis, okay? We kept it all vegetarian because we wanted to be able to drink this stuff. And so when the pizzas go in to this mixture, it's in the very beginning where we're actually extracting flavors from the malt and the barley and stuff. And we'll actually take and put about 5 gallons of hot water that we'll pour on the top of that once it's sat for about an hour and the flavors get infused. And we wash all the flavors off of the grains, and the flavors from the pizza get into the whole mix. And we boil it, ferment it, and in 2 weeks you have beer.
Wow.
Yeah, it's cool.
Now, has there ever been anything like this before? Like a more, I don't know, a savory type of beer? Like what you're doing, you know.
No. In fact, one of the problems we had when we were developing this beer is trying to find a resource that had made anything like this. And when we went on the internet before we even made the brew to say, okay, how do you brew with tomatoes? So I stick it in because I'm figuring some home brewer out there had to have done it. We couldn't find anything. We found a Japanese brewery who made beer with tomatoes because they wanted to make it more healthy for you. And the brewmaster was complaining about how he just couldn't stand his beer. And there were some articles about garlic in beer, but there wasn't anything about basil, oregano, or the combination of the four mentioned by anybody anywhere. So we figured, all right, if we invent this beer, we better write this recipe down. And we did. And so we're the first in the world, I think, to actually ever make a beer that is meant to be paired with a particular food or even have any sort of a food sort of flavor to it. So we're calling ourselves the world's first culinary beer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you said your wife, you know, when she first tasted it, you know, down the glass. What,
yes.
What other reactions have you been getting from people?
You know what? The first reaction is, you get some people who are like, they want to try everything. You know, they're the gung-ho. They run up and, let's try this stuff. And it's everything that they expect. Then you have the people who are a little skeptical. They look at it and they kind of hesitate. They smell it and their eyes kind of open up. They're going, and then they start giggling because it does smell like pizza. And then when they take a sip, the reaction is usually, wow, this is unbelievable. I was expecting something that was going to taste really bad, but this has a really, really pleasant aftertaste. There was we've had several celebrities try our beer, and even on, well, we were on national television. We popped a bottle open on national TV in front of millions of people, and this guy that was sitting next to me, I'm going to tell you, the way that that this guy is known in the business, his name is Mancow.
Yes.
Okay.
Familiar with,
you know,
Mancow?
Who he is?
Oh yeah, the radio personality.
Right. Mancow tried it, and he's not going to lie. If I had a harebrained idea, he's going to tell me what an idiot I am. And all he did is tell me, all he did is make the comment that I had man boobs in a rollover. So, and in fact, if later on he went up to me and said, I hope you weren't offended by that, but, you know, if I didn't like you, I would have said a lot worse things about you than that. But he loved the beer. Another guy, Bulldog, on the East Coast, he has a big radio show. He tried it. Several celebrities in town have tried it. Even there's a celebrity chef that I won't give his name out at this time, but tried it and gave me a call and just was like, man, we got to get together, Tom. So we're in talks with several people right now about getting this thing mass-produced.
Well, you know, honestly, you have tapped into something, and I think what you have created is the perfect guy drink.
Yes.
And, you know, pizza and beer, that is guy food, that is guy drink, that is, you know, total man stuff.
Yes.
Now, I guess that opens up the question, maybe there's a follow-up beer in your future, maybe, you know, the T-bone steak beer, or the chicken wing flavored beer. Have you thought about expanding this pizza beer, strange beer empire of yours?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, you just mentioned two things. What did you say? You said T-bone?
Yeah, T-bone steak and chicken wings.
And chicken wing, right?
Yeah.
Now, imagine yourself sitting down having a big, fat T-bone steak, and you're trying to figure out what to drink with it. And all of a sudden, someone puts this beer in front of your face that's made with salsa brewed into it.
That's pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what happens is that the peppers that we picked out are not, they're not the kind that are like on fire. Like some of that pepper beer, I just don't like it at all because it tastes like you've had a shot of bad whiskey. You know, it burns your throat. And so we were really choosy and figuring out what kind of peppers to use in this thing. And then just like in a good Cabernet Sauvignon where you get that green pepper flavor to the wine, this particular salsa beer has that same flavor. So you've got a good mixture of onions and peppers in the beer that go really well with the steak and hamburgers and that nature.
So what's the salsa beer called? Is it out yet?
It's called salsa beer.
Oh,
no,
okay.
It's not. That's a prototype that's going to, you asked me about follow-ups.
Okay.
And that's a prototype that we kind of followed up because that's the beer that I really wanted to do first, but pizza beer was the best mistake ever made. But anyway, the other beer you were talking about with the chicken, we were on local television in Utica, New York, and we demonstrated how you could take the pizza beer and inject chicken fryers and roast them in an oven, which we did on a food segment on a television show up there. And then afterwards, we took our Indian-inspired beer that has curry and a number of other things in it and actually had it with the chicken. And then the owner had some chicken wings, and we did with some hot wings, and that beer goes perfect with hot wings and chicken. So we are going to try to cover all the bases on this thing.
I love it. You're making me both hungry and thirsty all at the same time. I guess all at once as well.
Cool.
So the pizza beer, it is called Mamma Mia Pizza Beer, right?
That's the name of it, yes.
And where can that be found?
People can find us right now at pizzabeer.net. The only commercial example that was I agreed to make one batch and one batch only with Walter Payton's Roundhouse. And I think they may have a few bottles left in it. I know it got some really good reviews on Rate-A-Beer. And we don't have a contract with them to continue making it. It was just an agreement that we had to do the one batch just, you know, as an experiment type thing. And apparently it's done very well over there. So I'll be looking for it very soon, because today, in fact, just as you were calling, we sent in our papers for our federal wholesale license. So we plan on getting the process is that you have to get a wholesale license from the federal government, then get a state of Illinois license, and then we can begin having someone manufacture it and we can distribute it throughout Illinois.
So soon we'll be finding it on the store shelves.
I hope before Christmas time, I hope.
Well, that's good news for all those people who want to just get the pizza and the beer all in the same gulp.
Oh, yeah. For anybody that likes to eat and drink is going to love this stuff. And if you like to cook the pizza beer and the bread, I'll tell you what, you substitute water with pizza beer and make a French bread or a pizza dough, and we think we have actually a commercial product for the pizza industry. So if anyone out there in the pizza industry is listening and has a hankering to really spice up their pizza, our pizza beer in pizza dough is outstanding.
Wow. Well, best of luck with the Mamma Mia pizza beer, and I guess cheers.
Thank you, and bon appetit.
That was Tom Seifert, the creator of Mamma Mia Pizza Beer. You can find more about this brew on the web at mamamiapizzabeer.com. you're listening to Sidetrack. Water parks, with their giant slides and wading pools, are a classic summertime retreat. They are the perfect way to evade the hot and humid weather. For Londoner Neil McQuillan, once he discovered them, he became obsessed.
In London, when it's hot, there's nowhere to go. The city expands outwards round you, layer after layer of oppressively hot brick, stone, and concrete. Homes don't have air conditioning, nor do many public buildings. The large ornamental fountains in the parks have normally been out of order since the olden days, and the drinking fountains are relics to go with the old horse troughs filled with flowers. We don't have fire hydrants that conveniently go haywire. We do sometimes go to the seaside, but by the time we get there, the weather will probably have changed. So we walk by the river or in the parks, but it's always a case of delaying the inevitable, of keeping the heat at bay. We don't make friends with the heat or tame it, but then it just doesn't get all that hot in Britain. Not like here. A walk in the park just doesn't cut the mustard here. Drastic measures are required. Hence the water park, where mankind and sweltering heat come together in blissful union. I can't overstate how much the heat here has affected me during my month stay in Champagne. Every time I moved out of air-conditioned space, I exploded with sweat. The water parks I visited have been oases. There have been three. First, Sholem Aquatic Centre here in Champagne. Then, Caribbean Water Adventure in Springfield. And finally, Indiana Beach. Each one bigger than the next. I love them all. As they got bigger, it may well be that my overall excitement grew. But let that take nothing away from my delight as I sat in my tube and trundled gently down the modest length of unambitious slide that leads into Champagne's lazy river. Just because I wasn't screaming in terror as I did while plummeting down the Devil Ray, Springfield's dastardly bastardization of a skate park halfpipe, doesn't mean I wasn't feeling something very special indeed on the inside. The park in Champagne is small but perfectly formed, unlike Indiana Beach, which is small but bloated with steroids. The space has been used with restraint. When I went, it felt peaceful, which may be because it does not try to be non-stop thrills, and also because it's situated at a public park. As you climb the steps to the slides or luxuriate in the lazy river, you can see trees and grass around you, just beyond the perimeter fence. It's cheap enough to go to on a whim, just $5 for residents, and is perfect for water park virgins like myself. Springfield's Caribbean Water Adventure, on the other hand, is a little pricier, and you're surrounded by freeway rather than parkland. Nonetheless, it was my favourite of the three parks. The Devil Ray, that slippery halfpipe, brought out noises in my friend and I that grown men shouldn't be capable of. And another ride, like a huge toilet bowl, processed our puny frames with such disdain, flinging us round and round before plopping us gracelessly into the cistern, that there was as much pleasure to be had watching as there was in taking part. Springfield also had a powerful wave pool, which was a touch of class neither of us was expecting. It was sitting quietly over on the other side of the park, waiting for us to notice it, and it was the perfect place to let the slide adrenaline dissipate. Each ride was so different from the next here that we felt we got more than our money's worth. Craving bigger and bigger kicks, I gobbled up tales of the legendary Indiana Beach. My host promised that we would visit, and true to his word, the day finally came. We walked across a beautiful suspension bridge from the parking lot and entered a chaotic forging of roller coaster and water slide, spliced and crisscrossed along a sliver of land in Lake Schaefer. It has been put together in such a crazy angled, higgledy-piggledy fashion that just finding where to pay is a triumph. Finding anything actually is like finding Waldo. There were signs everywhere, leering at us like faces on a ghost train ride. Once on our way in the park, narrow walkway after narrow walkway, there was a sense of being herded, sheep going for their dip, whether they liked it or not. The swimming pool was lake water, with an artificial beach alongside. The sand was like chicken feed. A large metal canister, painted in flaking turquoise, muscularly pumped an arc of water over the swimming pool. It looked like it once serviced crops with fertilizer. I trust they gave it a good scrub before its career change. The lazy river there, actually called an action river, perhaps because of the speed of the water flow, getting you in and out as quickly as possible, passed directly beneath the slides and roller coaster tracks. It felt rather industrial, like we were flotsam floating on the top of some sort of cooling system in a factory. It also meant that one unfortunate lifeguard had to actually stand in the river here, in the dank shadows of the dripping coaster tracks and slide underbellies. I felt bad for him as I sailed lazily by. One sad fact I've found hard to swallow is that not everyone loves a water park like I do. The lifeguards, brown as berries, looked universally bored. Some sparked into life when spoken to, others didn't. One guard, attending the highest slides at Indiana Beach, was less than chatty. As we reached the top, excitedly trying to decide which slide to go down, another visitor, also chomping at the bit, came right out and asked her, the lifeguard, the person who would surely know, which is the best one? She adjusted her cap a little and shrugged, staring blankly into the middle distance. No matter, I thought. It's better to find out for yourself anyway. So for the record, I reckon the one on the right was better. You went further up the sides at the corners, and the links between the tube sections were pronounced enough to add the subtlest hint of pain to the journey down, which was actually kind of satisfying, like bumping down the stairs in a pillowcase. And there's the thing, I suppose. After just 3 water park trips, I was already fancying myself a connoisseur. A certain objectivity was creeping into my enjoyment. And objectivity can give way to cynicism, something I was going to the water parks to avoid.
That essay from Neil McQuillan. He visited Champaign from June to July this year. He's originally from Liverpool, but currently works and resides in London. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.